as was requested, I will try to speak some about the forms, the rituals, the details. And it's interesting that that question came up because before the meeting this morning, I was writing in a notebook, and it's a new notebook because the other one was full, and it has lines on the pages. And sometimes my notebooks have lines, and sometimes they don't. And it's a very different experience writing with the lines and without. I'm a writer and I write a lot. And I try different ways of writing, different pens, different paper, different places, different moments. And they each bring some different experience. And the experience of writing with lines, I realized, is similar to the experience of the forms here and the rituals here in a retreat. I chose the notebook. I knew it had lines, and I picked it for that reason, without really thinking about why, but I wanted it because it had lines. And this morning as I was writing, I started realizing something about it. The lines, I can rely on the lines. I can count on the lines. And I am therefore free to use the space that is given between the lines without limits. Each letter, each individual letter that I put on the page is joined with another letter and forms a word. And then each word joins with the next word and forms a sentence. And each sentence is joined with another sentence and makes a paragraph and makes a page and page after page. The same thing is true of when we come together here as individuals. We have, as I was saying yesterday with different words, there are two aspects of being. I think yesterday I said two aspects of reality, but today I feel more, I want to speak to you about being. And there are two aspects of that. One is what I said, diversity. This is the separate aspect of our being. The individual aspect, or what we can think of as the discontinuous being. Do you understand discontinuous? It's separate, it's cut up. The other aspect of our being is the unity aspect. The oneness, the non-separate, the continuous aspect. And this is inherent in everything and in each of us. It's not something that we have to create. It's not something that we have to attain. That's how we are. Those are the two aspects of our being. And when we come here, as individuals. We bring our individual separate beings with all of our different characteristics, the way we look, the way we dress, the way we think, our desires, our dislikes, our different positions in society, our different positions here, different ages, all of those differences. We bring those differences and we come together as one. But the experience of that oneness, of that continuous being, is facilitated by the rituals and the forms, like the lines on the page facilitate that experience of the words coming together and the phrases coming together, without having to think about where I will put the words and how many lines I will have on the page and how wide the lines should be. It's already established. And the same thing is true with the rituals and the forms here. The rituals and the forms here are very particular, but ritual in any tradition, any rite or ritual, serves the same purpose. So what I'm saying about this very particular Zen practice, a ritual in an office serves the same purpose. The individual workers in the office come together through some sort of ritual and join as one, as a team maybe, or in sports. You have certain rules and rites and rituals, and they serve to bring together the separate, disparate, discontinuous parts into a whole. And in those different situations, the rituals serve that purpose. However, the emphasis is not put on the experience of the oneness. The experience, the emphasis is put on the result. So the team will come together as one so they can score more goals. The workers will come together as one to produce a better product. In this context, or in most spiritual or religious context, the emphasis is not on attaining a goal or producing something, it's on the very experience of oneness. What is produced is secondary. What the goal is not to score a goal. The goal is just to experience what is. So maybe some examples would be useful. When we, well, maybe this is a good example. My clothing, or any clothing, but this clothing in particular. In some Zen retreats, everyone would be wearing this kind of clothing. Or most people would be. And originally that came from a monastic practice where people joined a monastery, became monks, and gave up all of their clothing, possessions, shaved their hair, given some other piece of clothing, and that's what they had. this was part of the ritual of abandoning a fixation on the personal, the separate, the individual, in order to experience the impersonal, the non-separate, the one, the unity. In my case, where I am not a monk, I am not a nun, I am just a person in everyday life, like all of you, it serves the same purpose. It's just a form that is put on as a reminder for myself, and it can also serve as a reminder for others of the impersonal. There is this person with a personal life, with a name, with a situation, nationality, family, different qualities, age, and there is the other aspect of this being, which is impersonal, which the impersonal manifests as the personal in each of our cases. I choose to, today, maybe tomorrow I won't, I don't know, today I choose to put on this as a reminder of that. It helps me to let go of the person, to let go of my attachment to that personal aspect, because I'm very attached to that personal aspect, like we all are. I'm very attached to my age, my children, my work. It doesn't mean I like my work, but I have a strong opinion about it. And that strong opinion, maybe I don't like it. I have a strong opinion about my children. I do like them. I love them. And I probably have a stronger opinion about my children than I do about her children, because I don't have the same relationship with her children as I have with my children. It doesn't mean I don't like her children, but in this personal aspect, my connection is with my children directly. So this, I put this on as a reminder. It helps me experience the impersonal. The same thing goes for all of the rituals. So, bowing, for example. I drop my, each time I bow, it's an opportunity to let go of the attachment to the personal. It's an opportunity to give myself the possibility to experience this impersonal aspect of my being, of each being of reality. It allows me to move from my discontinuous being to this continuous being that is limitless. It allows me to let go of my limits and abandon myself to the limitless. I'm not saying that every time I bow, that is my experience. But that is why I bow. That is the meaning, if you will, of bowing. The same goes for the schedule. We set a schedule with times. We have someone who rings the bell at a specific moment. Our sitting time is exactly 40 minutes, unless we are behind schedule, which happens. And then the time will be shorter, but it will end exactly when it was scheduled to end. Again, This is so that we can let go of our attachment to our personal, I want to sit longer, or I don't want to sit this long, or I like this position, or I don't like this position. It doesn't mean we don't have those opinions. We do. Everybody has an opinion about it. Sometimes we share the same opinion. Ah, I like this sitting. Sometimes we share the opinion, I don't like this. This is painful, this is boring, this is stupid, whatever our opinions are. Because there is the schedule, because there is this ritual, we have the possibility of not sticking to that opinion, of being free of it. We still have it, maybe. I don't know. But we're not limited by it. We have the opportunity to experience something else. We just give ourselves to that ritual. Okay, this is what I do. The same thing with eating. We have an idea of what we want for breakfast. Personally, the personal aspect, I would not eat that for breakfast if I were making breakfast. I accept to free myself of that attachment of what I want for breakfast and when I want breakfast and when I want to wake up, and I give myself to the schedule. 6:30, that's the time to get up. I'm free. I don't have to be limited by my idea that I want to sleep until 10. Or that I want bread with confiture, with jam for breakfast. Or that I want my tea. My favorite tea. I drop it. And it's so liberating to drop it, to not be fixed by this small picture I have of what breakfast is and when breakfast is. The same with being served. I drop my idea of how I should put it in my bowl, when I want it in my bowl, how much I want. I can ask for just that much, or I can ask for more. But because it's in this ritual context, it's no longer about this personal. I am joining with all of the others, and I have less demands. I'm freed of, oh, I need much more food, or I want a different kind of food. Or I want to get up from the table now. Or I don't want to get up from the table. I just get up when it's time to get up. And I'm free from these attachments, from this I keep using the same words over and over again. And I brought this my notebook because I had some notes that I had made quite some time ago about this, and I just happened to have the the notebook with me. Usually I don't refer to notes when I do these talks, but yeah, okay. So in the we don't really understand the rituals, right? We don't understand why we eat like that. We don't understand why we have a schedule. We don't understand why we bow. We don't understand why we chant things. Here, we don't much. The only one who says anything, really, is at night, at the very end, someone says something to us. If I were in a different context, in France, for example, in a retreat, there would be chanting, because the context is more appropriate for it. Here it's not. No. It might be tomorrow, I don't know. Today it's not. But we don't understand any of it, the rituals. And that's, I would say that's the point. But that's also the nature of the ritual. In this discontinuous being, in this separate being, in this isolated being, everything is coherent. Everything has its... We can identify differences, we can see the... We can understand the words, we can explain why things are the way they are. We can explain, we do this because of that. But when we drop the personal aspect, our attachment to the personal aspect, and abandon ourselves to the ritual, we enter the incomprehensible, the irrational, the incoherent. And that frees, going into that incoherent aspect, frees us, liberates us from the attachment and the need to be coherent. And we discover this other aspect. It's like at night, after the sitting, I go into my room. It's dark. I can't distinguish the bed, the chair, the windows, nothing. I flip the light on, and suddenly everything is distinguished. It's clear. I can see the differences. I can see where everything is. Well, that experience of the darkness has a quality, has a beauty in itself that we can appreciate if we aren't attached to the idea of having the light on. The same thing is true of this, that we can appreciate this letting go to the incoherent, to the inexplicable aspect, when we have the ritual to rely on, like the lines of the page. When I have those lines on the page, I can just write without thinking where I will put the next line. I'm free to just let it flow, join the flow of the words. The ritual appears very strict, and in fact, it's not. As Crystal knows as well, sometimes in retreats in different groups, the rituals are much more strict. And some of you who have experienced other, well, you know, and who you've probably experienced some rituals that are more strict. In Gallery 2, you said you went once to Zen class. It all depends on context. and how who's ever leading the group manifests the ritual. So in my case, as the question was asked this morning, will you correct our posture? And I said no, because there is no right and wrong. There is a posture. What's important is not making the posture exactly a right way or a wrong way. What's important is maintaining the posture. What's important is maintaining the ritual. But the ritual only has meaning if it works in the context. What is the intention of the ritual? And if it becomes just to have ritual, it loses its meaning. So within each context, each situation, time, place, quantity, people, whatever the situation is, the ritual adapts to that with the intention, the same intention of being the lines upon which we write, of being the container within which we drop our attachments to personal, separate, different, fragmented. An example, another very clear example is my colleague, my sister, if you will, in this practice, who at the beginning of the month became a teacher like me, what we call received transmission from our teacher. Her name that she was given by our teacher, we each have a name, is in French, joie partagée, which means shared joy. This is a traditional a very old concept, an old name that probably predates Buddhism, although it exists in the Tibetan tradition and it exists in the ancient Indian Buddhist tradition, but probably predates that and is part of the very, very ancient Indian Advaita Vedantist tradition. The thing is that this name applies to this woman because that's what she does. She tells jokes. She can be very funny, but not funny in like a comedian. But comedians have this quality as well. But this name really is appropriate for her because she shares her joy. It's contagious. It's like you become sick with it, almost. Not all the time, but this is one of her qualities. And how I describe it is that it's as if we were each individual beads, you know, like individual beads. And with her stories, her jokes, her presence sometimes, she makes us laugh. She makes us joyous. And that is the thread. The thread, the string.
Coin.
That strings us all together as one. At that moment, when we're laughing, when we're smiling, we're not separate. One. The laughter takes us out of our personal to the impersonal. Humor does this. Laughter does this. Not only humor does it. Fear can do it as well. Any sort of powerful emotion in a way that we don't normally think of it as this way, but anything that we think of as being erotic does that as well. And not only in a sexual context, erotic. I think of eroticism as being something that takes us away from the personal and allows us to experience unity. It can be a work of art. It can be, and I always use this example, some of you have heard it many times probably, of a moment that seemingly would not be spiritual, would not be, would seem to be completely ordinary. An exceptional sports moment can be it. It's a shared experience of, and the example I always give is a goal that I saw Zinedine Zidane score once. Or it can be watching Roger Federer hit the ball sometimes, the tennis player. It transcends the personal and it's something else happens. Ritual allows us, gives us access to that impersonal aspect. And we could say almost that in the case of joie partagée, there is a ritual in the telling of the joke. There is setting it up, telling the story. There was a guy who did this, someone else did that. And then there's something in the story that maybe is confusing, and then suddenly there's the punchline, we say in English, the line that the catch line, I don't know how you would say that in, what do you say for a joke, that the moment when the joke is... the key phrase or something, yeah. And that's part of the ritual of the joke telling. And if any of those aspects are not respected, the joke doesn't work. If you tell the end line first, forget it. It doesn't work. And we all agree, we know what's going to happen. We all know that this is how it works. And we drop it. We know that that's how it works, the form, but we don't know how. It's totally irrational. We don't know how we will get from there was a man in the street to whatever happens. We give ourselves to the incoherence of it. And we arrive at this shared joy, which, like I said, the laughter is the string that joins us. We're one in that moment. So So when we give up this we hesitate to give it up, let's say. We hesitate to... I know the first time I came to a retreat like this, I didn't know what was going on. No one told me anything. I came because I loved to sit, but I just sat by myself. I didn't know anyone who sat like this. And I wanted to... I had this desire to share it with other people, to know other people who did this too. That's all I knew. And I came and there were all these things, these rituals and this bowing and chanting, and it was much more than this. And everyone was wearing these robes and I was in a t-shirt and shorts. I had no idea. And it was very strange. And at night, after the first day, at night, suddenly in the dark, this voice started saying something, what Luisa is saying. It was a little frightening to hear it, about life and death, and opportunities being lost. Don't squander your life. And it was said so directly, and I thought it was coming right at me, out of the darkness. And in that, at that time, the group was sitting facing the wall. So, which is a traditional, in some Zen schools, way of sitting. Everyone was facing the wall. So I couldn't even see what was happening, who was talking, what people were doing. I had no clue. And then bells rang and people started bowing and I didn't know what was going on. But there was something so powerful in my desire to sit, and something even in that confusion, something so powerful and something attractive about it. There was something I liked about this confusion, this not knowing. Although there, it was frightening as well. And I resisted it as well. But something appealed to me in it. And so I kept coming back. And I also had a very strong attraction, a strong connection with the teacher. I couldn't explain that either. But I just liked to hear what she said, and I liked to be with her, but I couldn't really explain that either. But it didn't matter. I was willing to drop it. And little by little, okay, they said, this is what you do at this time, I do it. This is what we say at this time. It didn't matter what I was saying, I just said it. I trusted the ritual. I trusted that something was happening to me through that. Of course, then I would pass through moments when I didn't know what I was doing and I hated it and I didn't do it. I didn't, for a long time, I didn't wear a robe like this. But I came to not think about it so much. To just experience it. And the more I didn't think about it, the more I experienced it. The more I thought about it, the more I was separate. The less I thought about it, And Laura was not separate, which was what I wanted. I wanted to feel one. I wanted to be not isolated. That's why I came to the group, was to not be isolated in a very concrete way. Now, there's also the problem that we have always in when we talk about dualities, personal, impersonal, fixed, not fixed, light, dark, coherent, incoherent. We tend to think of those things as opposites, and therefore, if it is one, it's not the other. Excuse me. If it's this one, it's not this one. And we have difficulty holding them both. But in fact, they are both always present, these two aspects, the personal and the impersonal. For me, in my very personal process, my personal interpretation and understanding and manifestation of these teachings, I express the impersonal and the personal as being a woman in the 21st century with two children, earning my living, living in a house with my husband and children, without abandoning my practice, my formal practice. The personal and the impersonal are expressed in that way, as it's expressed wearing this robe, but having hair. And even some people think, there are some people who think, okay, it's okay to have hair, but not wild hair. It should be short hair. Or, okay, but no earrings, you see. You know, there would be different, there are different degrees to it. It so happens that this is how I manifest it. Today, as I say. Tomorrow, it may be different. Tomorrow, it will be different. I think the last time I was in Portugal, in April, and I, this issue of the forms and the rituals came up, and I did the same thing. I gave a talk on it. But I chose that day to come not wearing my robes. And some of you were there. I don't know if you know, maybe you had left. Chaga was there. And I was saying the same thing. But it seemed appropriate in that moment to manifest it without the robes. I'm not saying I was sitting here naked, which would have been another way, but it wouldn't have been appropriate to express it that way. In another moment, that is appropriate, but not in this moment. So any, oh yes, I know what I was saying about the two dualities. So if we fix ourselves in one or the other, if we say, okay, ah yes, the impersonal, that's what I want. Again, we are limiting ourselves. right? Of course, you know what I'm going to say, right? If we say, okay, the personal, we limit ourselves again. We can't fix ourselves in either one. Either one is to exclude the other. So this is a practice of including, not excluding. It's not saying, I will exclude the personal so I can experience the impersonal. Or it's not saying, I will exclude the impersonal so I can experience the personal. Which is usually what we do. So we come to a situation like this, and we say, oh, no, I don't want to let go of my... I don't like that. I don't want to sit now. I don't want to be silent. I don't like that food. I will go eat somewhere else. That is fixing to the personal. That's excluding the impersonal. If we only acknowledge the impersonal, there is no personal. There are no preferences. Nothing matters. We're excluding the personal. Each of us manifests in a different way. We're not all the same. And we have a better chance of experiencing that and sharing that. We can share our personal, each of us laughs in a different way. But when we laugh as one, all of those individual laughters come together as one. And it feels different than when we laugh by ourselves. Singing is the same way. If we sing by ourselves, it's not the same thing as singing as a choir, as a chorus. And if in joining in the chorus, the choir, we hold to our way of singing, something won't be right. We have to give up. We think the song should go like this. Give that up in order to sing it as one, together. Same thing with the rituals here. And any, I also use an example of a political example. In political systems, we have democracy as an option, right? That's a possible system, political system, which is very popular these days. And some democracies want to impose democracies on other countries. I'm thinking of one democracy in particular that wants to impose its system on other countries. The problem with democracy is that what wins in a democracy is what is the preference of the most people. So whatever the majority decides is preferable, that's what happens. It's not necessarily what's best. It's not necessarily what's right. It's not necessarily what's just. It's not necessarily what's true. It's just what the greatest number of people think. This is an attachment to the personal. Personal preference. And all of these personal preferences come together, and the personal preference that is shared by the most people is what is decided. And then we have the opposite, totalitarianism, which is an attachment to the impersonal. There are no individuals. No one has preferences. They do, but they're not recognized. No one is separate. Everyone is part of the whole. This too is a self, an individual, personal self, being attached to the impersonal. This is what happens when there is an attachment to the impersonal. I can't give you an example of a political system that would best embody, including both aspects. I say I can't because I don't know, and I won't pretend that I do. I'm not a politician, and I don't function, I don't study political theory. I'm just giving this as an example in a very concrete way. And if you look around, you will see these different aspects of reality expressing themselves in any number of ways. The limited and the unlimited, the fragmented and the whole. The small and the vast. So the aspect of our being that is coherent, that is personal, develops rituals as a way of experiencing the other aspect. That's all. It's not any more complicated than that. Very quickly, that aspect of being that wants coherence and rationality will start creating all sorts of complicated things about the ritual and start making it very strict, forcing it upon people, forcing democracy on people. And in some, this is how we get churches, right? Christ's initial message had nothing to do with the rituals that are now practiced in most churches. And the Buddha's initial message had nothing to do with this black robe, actually. However, we have developed different rituals, the Christians developed different rituals, as a way of experiencing Christ's message. And that's the same thing that we have done with the rituals. If we can not focus so much on the different aspects of the ritual, drop our attachment to wanting to understand it and just experience it, something else happens. This is when we have, as one, we can have an experience of continuous being, of non-isolation, of the whole instead of the fragments. Each one of us within our beings is also whole and fragmented. We have different aspects of that being. And that it's endless. So, any questions or... comments? Or were there particular rituals or poems that you would like to know?
What kind of rituals can we do in our daily life? Sitting?
Yes, and even you can even make your own ritual for sitting. You can set a time when you do it. I suggest that it's best to, if you can, say, I will do it every night at such a time, or three times a week at this time, or once a week at this time, whatever works. And set a time limit. So if your schedule is very busy and you can only do 10 minutes, 5 minutes, fine, whatever. Set that as a frame. I recommend doing it always in the same place, if you can. So you have a chair that you sit in, or you have a room that you sit in. You can even make it more elaborate. You can light a candle, you can do incense. Music is possible, although I wouldn't recommend it, because it adds something for your mind to deal with, and it's better to eliminate as much as possible so that your mind has plenty going on anyway. And if there's music in addition to that, it makes it more complicated.
Music before.
And then you sit after.
Yeah.
Sure. That's part of your ritual.
Yes.
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Classic.
So that's a ritual, yes, around sitting. And it's a big help if you do have a ritual. It gives you structure. I give the example often of the river and the banks. If there are no banks, then the river becomes a puddle. But if you give yourself those banks, then the river can move freely. You do have other rituals in your day. You know, you wake up at a certain time. When you wake up, you do certain things. You have a shower, you eat, you brush your teeth, you go to work, you follow the same road probably, I don't know, whatever you do. We can have rituals that we choose in order to simplify our day, but we can also use rituals to, as in this case, help us to experience that impersonal aspect. As myself, I wear this mala as a reminder during the day. I become aware of it. Sometimes I don't even think about it. Sometimes when I'm working at my desk or computer, I hear it and I remember. Not necessarily consciously every time, but it's part of my ritual that I bring with me everywhere.
You remember what?
What? I remember to be here now. To be here now. Bring my awareness back to now. Oh yes, I'm here. Well, that's a vast question. And also, as I said, I think it was yesterday, I don't know, there is nothing to attain. However, we do the meditation because we want to realize that. That there is nothing to attain. That we are already there. We don't have to go somewhere. We don't have to get something. But we don't experience that usually. And so this is the ritual we have chosen in order to experience that. Or we hope that we will experience that. It won't look like we think it will. Our ideas about it will not correspond to what our experience is. Fortunately. Because if they did, it would just be an idea. This aspect I'm talking about, this impersonal aspect, can never be seen. It can't be seen like the personal aspect is seen. We can see how each individual looks differently, but we can never see the impersonal aspect. It can only be experienced. And that is why we do this, to have an experience of our being, instead of reading about it, talking about it, seeing it, thinking it, understanding it. It's to truly experience it. And we have a saying in Zen that if someone explains too much, their eyebrows will fall out. Explaining too much means trying to say what can't be said. Staying with the ideas about something rather than experiencing it. And so I am constantly trying to keep from losing my eyebrows. So I can't say more.
I have the need to say like a prayer. I need to say it every day, and I don't know what to say. Like a Tibetan. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have some things they say.
Mantra?
No.
Dedication.
Yes. I hope I can see the truth and all beings can see the truth. I want to say like a prayer every day so I can listen. And I don't know what to say to in Zen, does it have some words to say?
In the rituals we have dedications that we make. We don't do it like the Tibetans do. The Tibetans do it before every time they sit, which is beautiful. Really beautiful practice. Sometimes I do that myself. It's not part of the Zen ritual in that aspect. We do that with the bow before the cushion. It serves the same purpose as the Tibetan dedication does. Again, it's a ritual that takes us from our fixed position of the personal to the impersonal. And that's what the Tibetan dedications do as well. The Tibetan mantras, the same thing. Any ritual does that. And our bowing to the cushion before we sit, and our bowing to the others when we turn around, and our bowing at the end of sitting, all serve that same purpose. You probably, in yourself, can find the words that you want to say. It doesn't have to come outside, from outside. It's best if it comes from you, in fact. I can tell you what some of the... I just happen to have a thing here with the rituals, with the dedications. You know, it says like... we dedicate its merits to peace throughout the world, the families of Sangha members, to all the participants, to all beings throughout the world. May penetrating light dispel the darkness of ignorance. May all karma be wiped out. And the mind flower bloom in eternal spring. And may we realize the Buddha way together, which is very important. May it not be just me. So it's another way of saying, may we as one, all together, realize it.
Does the word compassion exist also in them?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. It's compassion is the functioning of wisdom. So wisdom is seeing the oneness of life, the oneness of all beings, the non-separation, the impersonal, say. And once we have seen that, once we've experienced that, not seen, experienced that, the natural functioning of that is compassion. Because we have experienced that we are not separate from the others. And so the action of wisdom is compassion. And that is expressed on my other Rakusu, there's something written about that. But here is written how wonderful all beings have the wisdom and virtue of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is another name for the Buddha, meaning the one who has awakened. And
it means illuminate, isn't it?
It means the one who has been revealed. And these words are supposedly what Shakyamuni, the man who we call the Buddha, said upon his awakening. What he realized was the oneness. Everyone throughout all space, time, age, time, place, has this same nature. This is the oneness that he realized. He realized that he couldn't, again, this comes back to losing the eyebrows. He couldn't say it. He couldn't tell anyone that. They had to experience it for themselves. And so he initially thought, okay, I will not say anything. I can't. There's nothing to say. And he went and sat by himself again. But then after a certain time, he thought, no, he thought about his friends who he had left in the forest. And he thought, no, I want to go tell them about this. I want to see what... Before he said, I want to tell them, he said, I want to see how they are. He saw, he remembered what they had been doing and how he had been doing that too, and how that was not the way. That there was another way. And that he wanted to see them. And if he could somehow show them that there was another way. So right there, the compassion was born. He remembered, he recognized their pain and suffering because it was his. And because he had realized there was a way to not suffer like that, this compassion came up in him and he wanted to share that with them, with his friends. He didn't know how. And he went, and when they saw him, they saw that there was something different about him. He didn't look like he had looked before. He had changed because he had eaten. He had gone off into the world and done something different. They had not been eating. They had not been shaving, cutting their hair, whatever. They saw something different about him. And they also recognized in him something that had changed that was not, couldn't be seen, but that was felt and experienced. They experienced something different about his being. And they went, one of them came to him and said, please tell us, what, where have you been? What have you been doing? What happened to you? And at that point, he knew that he had to say something. Again, from his this organic compassion that was born of his wisdom, he said something. Spoke, and he told them. And they followed him. And he showed them how to do what he did. He showed them how they could experience, by following what he had followed, they could experience what he had experienced. And from there, he told more people. And then he told more people, and he told more people. All he was doing was telling them his experience. And then they, he would say to them, don't believe what I tell you, experience it for yourself. Which is the ultimate expression of compassion. Compassion is not imposing something on someone. It's sharing your experience and allowing them to have their experience. To not share it is to not be freely functioning with compassion. If the context applies. I don't sit in my office at the newspaper and talk to people like this. It's not appropriate. Something else is appropriate, and I have a compassionate experience with my colleagues in a different way. But that awareness of my non-separation and that action of compassion is always present, but it's manifest in a different way. So yes, that is one of the pillars of Zen, but also of all Buddhist practice, especially in the Mahayana branch, which is also Tibetan Buddhism, where the ultimate attainment, if you will, is that we are free only by freeing others, that only when others are free will I be free. We are all in this together again. So it's not about an individual attainment, it's not about an individual personal attainment. It's, like I said, the impersonal. The realization is of the impersonal. And then the compassion, the functioning of that realization is expressed in a personal way.